Hello and welcome to Promenade Culture Center. This is Culture Corner. Our guest today is Nada Fares, a writer and literary translator. As we bring you the authentic stories of creative individuals, we will dive right into these topics with Nada today, and we're looking forward to a great conversation. Nada, very warm welcome.
Hello, hello.
To Culture Corner, and so great to have you here today.
Thank you very much.
Like I said, we want to dive in into creativity because when I think of you, I think of everything creative.
That's of, really kind.
Of different things you do, of the approach you have to the things you do, of your interest and engagement with community. And I've realized, even though we've spoken about creativity so many times in this room, we've never really tried to define it. And maybe you might be the perfect person to do so today for us.
No pressure, huh?
No, this is something that I'm sure will bring us a lot of different topics as well. How do you feel about creativity? What is it? Do we overuse it? Do we abuse the word?
Well, actually, I think then this would be the perfect segue to start into grounding the conversation in historical moments. Mm-hmm. Because you're right, we talk about creativity all the time. Right. So 2,400 years ago, maybe 2,000, almost 500 years ago, Plato told us that creativity is divine inspiration, that it is something that is supernatural. Mm. Right. And in fact, a person who becomes creative experiences temporary madness. Right. Mm. He has to lose control of the world, of this physical, logical reality to tap into creativity. But then his own student, Aristotle, decided that actually, no, creativity is a very natural component of the human condition. It is something that you can practice. It is something that you can get better at. It is not the element of the divine or the world of spirit. It is very physical. So for the next 2,400 years, almost 2,500 years, we keep going back to the same conversation. Is creativity something that is outside of us that we have to tap into? Or is creativity internal? Somewhere along the line of human history, people decided, why does it have to be either or? Mm. Why can it not be both, right? Yeah. The more that you improve your own vessel, your own ability to hear better, to see better, to write better, obviously you're going to be able to tap into something that you wouldn't have been able to tap into before, right? So that's generally what people have been talking about for thousands of years. Mm. But for me specifically, when I think of creativity, because you're right, I don't just see it in those terms, an outcome, like a codified aesthetic medium. Are we writing a poem or a short story or music, film, etc.? I also believe creativity is what we do on an individual level, how we show parts of ourselves to others, right? So creativity for me is internal, but then also whatever happens internally can be shared with others.
I was wondering, since creativity and inspiration are a match made in heaven, does inspiration have to find us working?
Maybe and maybe not. I think that's the thing about inspiration is you can't know in advance when the muse is going to show up. Sometimes she shows up in your car.
Yeah.
You're not working, but you're driving, right? So I don't know that it only shows up when we're working, but it certainly makes a lot of a difference if we were, because then we can hold it better.
I have problems finding little pieces of paper to quickly write down things that come to mind when I have a sudden leap of inspiration, so to say. Also, authenticity. Again, a word that we use a lot. And even though I really like when we say that it's important in how we live and that we need to live authentically, is this something that we can define and that it is related to creativity as well?
Yeah.
Or expressing that creativity.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I think for me, this is the biggest question of my life. Mm. How to be authentic in ways that are also supportive of a sense of connection with others and and strengthening one's belonging. Because I feel like in Western environments, when we talk about authenticity, there's a sense of privilege that you can be authentic despite, you can disrupt, etc. And I don't feel like people can be authentic despite, everywhere in the world. So for me, I think the question has always been, how can you be authentic and still connect and still belong? But also, why does creativity play a role in how someone in this context can become authentic? And I mean, thankfully, nowadays, psychology has written a lot about the importance of creativity for the human condition. And one of the books that comes to mind is Bessel van der Kolk's popular, like, you know, New York Times bestseller book, The Body Keeps the Score. With your permission, may I read like two important
quotes? Absolutely, please do.
So the first quote is about imagination in the context of people experiencing trauma. Okay. So van der Kolk says, when people are compulsively and constantly pulled back into the past to the last time they felt intense involvement and deep emotions, they suffer from a failure of imagination, a loss of mental flexibility. Without imagination, there is no hope, no chance to envision a better future, no place to go, no goal to reach. So creativity doesn't just help us write poems and short stories or make music and film. Creativity is the very cognitive skills that allow us to see a way out of our mental loops, our pain, our suffering. And then on the context of authenticity, he also gives us a very important quote. He says, trauma results in a fundamental reorganization of the way mind and brain manage perceptions. It changes not only how we think and what we think about, but also our very capacity to think. We have discovered that helping victims of trauma find words to describe what has happened to them is profoundly meaningful, but usually it is not enough. The act of telling the story doesn't necessarily alter the automatic physical and hormonal responses of bodies that remain hypervigilant, prepared to be assaulted or violated at any time. For real change to take place, the body needs to learn that the danger has passed and to live in the reality of the present. So it is fundamentally important that we go back to the basics in all of our educational systems, in our home environments. We have to nurture children's ability to imagine. We have to allow them to think outside the box, because if we don't, we're not just curbing their ability to make art, we're really preventing them from being able to bounce back after failure or heal after trauma. It's an especially important skill to teach to anyone.
I recently spoke to a friend who works at the Faculty of Physical Education, and he said, we have lost physical literacy. Yeah. Kids can't climb a tree.
Yeah.
Because the tree is not a concept anymore. And I think losing concepts, the idea of certain things existing, is dreadful.
Yeah.
Now that I think of it. Thank you for sharing these.
You're welcome.
And what a great and scary book, I must say. I was trying to remember, I read that in Serbian, trying to remember which are the, well, it's been translated. It's a big book. I mean, probably to many, many other languages. I was just wondering if I can remember the parts where I read it. And we will talk about language more. I'd like us to move, before actually moving to your creativity and your creative path, which is tremendously interesting. I have a question that I frequently ask to creators of various sorts. Do we need to create in order to exist?
That's a good question. I can answer this question on a personal level, but also as someone who's been in this field for now more than 15 years, speaking to people of all colors. I don't think you need to create to live. There are really important individuals who've never read a book in their lives, who've never seen a movie, and their contributions are fundamental to our collective world building. However, like, having said that, I do believe that those who are privileged enough to be able to engage with literature and culture in its myriad forms, I think those people shouldn't belittle the gift that they have, because it is a gift. It is a privilege to be able to read. It is a privilege to be able to watch movies at will, and to be able to engage with culture in such a way that isn't just pastime consumption, but rather a transformative experience, something that transforms you. What a gift it is to then go back to your family or your friends having already been transformed. Like, I think this is a sense of magic that is a privilege that people are discarding on a daily basis.
Both in families and unfortunately in our education systems, it feels. Let's go to let's go back to what I mentioned about your path. I think what inspires people most who listen and respond to this podcast is these individual stories that are real. People want real stories. When you chose what you chose to do in life, what did that look like? How do you feel about your creativity, your own path, whatever you would like to share? Obviously, there's no manual. We are not asking for, you know, specific details. And also very important, how do you feed that creativity? What you do to keep it alive?
Well, my journey, I feel like a lot of other creatives, it started in childhood. Your body, if you're living authentically, purely, your body already responds to the kind of activities it wants to do. And from a very young age, I was drawn to reading and writing stories, poems, but also dance. Like, I remember when I was very young, I'd gather all of my cousins together and teach them a choreography for the Spice Girls or the New Kids on the Block. And then, during Zwara, the Thursday gathering, we'd perform that to my aunts and uncles and cousins. So I was always drawn to creativity, but a boundaryless form of creativity, just expressing different parts of the selves through those different mediums. When I became 17, however, I decided very seriously that I was going to not just be a creative who shares their self-expression, but that I wanted to be a professional at some point. And I wanted to be a professional in one particular modality. So at 17, I said, okay, for the next 10 years, I'm just going to focus on writing. I'm going to improve my skills. I'm going to read a lot of books. I'm going to just immerse myself in everything.
That's a serious plan.
10 years. I wrote it down and I said, by 27, I am going to start my professional writing career.
You did that?
Of course.
As we know. Yeah. As we know, you kept yourself on the path. What would you say your creativity is based on? What are some essential things that creativity in general, let's say for someone who wants to do a job similar to yours or a professional orientation similar to yours, what is essential?
I think, honestly, one of the great things about our careers is that there are no blueprints. Like, every creative has the right to prioritize the goals that they want. And, you know, I'm somebody, I always say, like, humility is something I like in others, but it's not something I want to adopt for myself. So I'm fine. Like, I show up egotistically, I'm fine. That's part of my creative expression as well. So
when you actually show up authentically.
Oh, thank you. But it's still egotistically, which I'm fine. I'm fine with that. Okay. But I mean, some people call it confidence. Some people call it arrogance. I don't care. As long as I know that I'm showing up empowered and not disempowered. And yes, you can show up empowered while also being humble. And for me, that real intersection is what I'm interested in. I am not interested in like self-deprecating jokes or whatever. Like, that's popular nowadays. Yeah. Like, that's not my thing. But when it comes to my creativity, as I said, I wanted to be a professional. So I asked myself, what drives me as a professional who is not very humble? And for me, it's the drive to get better. Like, I'm, you know, Eminem says, I bully myself because they make me do the things I put my mind to. And I'm like that too. If Today, I will wake up and I will ask myself, did the Neda of yesterday do the things that make my life easier today? Because if she didn't, I'm going to get really mad at her.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm driven by the idea that every day I'm going to get better.
Mm.
That's when I write anything, poem, essay, and somebody reads it today, but then they read my work next year, I want them to go, oh, what did you, how did you do that?
Mm.
I do that through bullying myself to be better because that's my goal as a creative.
I'm interested in literature in general and that path when you choose what people would see simply as books.
Hmm.
For young people who are deciding, you know, whether they're going to go for this love, deep love for literature.
Mm.
And I think with literature, something really magnetically draws you to it. Maybe it's like that with other occupations as well. I'm not sure, other fields. What do you study for 4 or 5 years, you know? What is it that you do? What it is that one does that there are certain sets of skills you take, certain tools and certain knowledge. Mm. What was that for you while studying literature? And did you ever question that choice? I mean, obviously, I would say no from what you just shared. But, you know, a young person can get into a dilemma of whether something they're doing is right or not. The lucky ones know from early age.
That's a good point because it's a distinction. Maybe the lucky young ones know, but their parents don't know.
Mm.
Then how lucky are they?
I know, right? I know. That's
so
true.
In my case, I knew from a very young age that I wanted to be a writer. When I was 12, I knew that I was going to be a writer, but at that point, I didn't know writer and what else.
Mm.
When I was 17, I was like, no, we're focusing on writing, but we're doing like all the kinds of writing.
Yeah.
Poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. And then when I enrolled in the College of Arts, one of the things you discover, like you said, you're not just reading fiction, right? You're not just reading poetry, and you're not just reading plays. You're reading everything in the humanities.
Mm.
You're reading psychology, you're reading philosophy, you're reading politics, you're reading history, and then also a little bit of religion or spirituality. Mm. There are so many different layers and components to the for the human condition that become suddenly available to you in this campus kind of playground, right? So for me, and you're right, some people might be confused about what they wanted. I never was, even though like my parents wanted me to become an engineer. So I was 15 years old when I graduated from high school. Mm. And, you know,
I did not know that. Okay, that's very early. So we have a prodigy. Yes, I wasn't aware of that.
No.
But that's such a young age.
I was accepted into the College of Engineering at 15.
Mm.
It wasn't my choice. Like, you know, my mom and I didn't see eye to eye about this.
Mm.
But in order for me to remain authentic to my desires, but also to rebel, I had an older cousin who was already studying in the College of Arts, and I would call her up because I was 15. I didn't have a car. Like, my dad would drop me off at university.
Yeah, you can go to college, but you cannot drive.
Yeah, okay. I cannot drive.
Yeah.
So I would call my cousin in the College of Arts and I would tell her, hey, Yuna, can I attend your classes today? Mm. And like, this was my level of rebellion. So she'd come, she'd pick me up, and then I'd attend her classes. And then by the end of this, because I would also do like their homeworks and I'd take their quizzes. And at that time, teachers weren't taking attendance.
Mm.
So
you were able to sneak in.
Yeah, I'd be able to sneak in. And the professors, like around the midterm, when they hand me back my exam, they're like, I didn't see your name in the roster. This is when, you know, I'd come clean and I'd say, I'm actually not a student. So for me, I always knew what I wanted. I was taking classes in the College of Arts before I majored, and then I majored there, and then I graduated, and the assistant dean of the academic affairs, Dr. Yusur al-Madani, she told me, I'd like you to work for me in the office. So then I became an admin in the Faculty of Arts from 2006 to 2016. And on my lunch breaks or tea breaks, I'd tell my colleagues, all right, guys, I'm going to just go take classes and come back. So I'd just walk, you know, wander in the hallways. If I see a professor, I've already taken classes with this professor. But if I see them and I see what are you teaching today? Plato? Are you teaching Freud? Are you teaching Marx?
But isn't it true that every time you hear something different?
Perfect. This is something I want like everybody in the world to know because, you know, some people talk about before there was a popular concept that literature is universal, right? And I think that concept was taken out of hand. It became something very narrow. It started to mean that one person's experience can translate to every other person's experience. You can't write about race. You can't write about your particular... But I feel like that was never the point to begin with. Literature is universal. If what we mean by universal, not that one book can be read by everyone all the time, but rather that one book can transcend the moment so that you can read a book. I can give you an example. When I was in school, this is before university, they taught us Shakespeare. Right? When they teach you Shakespeare in school, sometimes there really is no connection to this dead, old, white British man who's writing in funny English, right? But then I rediscovered Shakespeare when I transferred from the College of Arts, from the College of Engineering to the College of Arts. And a group of friends, a group of people and I, we decided to do the first English day. And me and some people decided that for the first English day, we are going to put on some Shakespearean skits. And I rediscovered Twelfth Night and Macbeth, like the gender-bending comedy in Twelfth Night and the like the dark, witchy, complex conversation on power in Macbeth. I saw them in completely different light. And yet I was on stage now, performing in such a way that was so far off my current lived experiences. And yet I never felt more authentic or more represented on that stage in my life.
I think that's why it still stays on everywhere and for every generation. You really can discover something. There's something very unique about this this particular writer.
Shakespeare?
Yeah.
Shakespeare is phenomenal. I'm now one of his like biggest advocates. I know I have a lot of friends who still tell me because they, you know, they only met him in high school. And for me, I'm like, forget about what English teachers say. You want to discover Shakespeare as a creative. Like, show up to his plays as a creative, and then look at the level of technicality and the bravado and like just the complexity, the intricate weaving of elements. It, for me, I can never get enough of him.
I agree. I've read it in English, but also in Serbian. And fortunately, there was a whole... you know, school of translation for Shakespeare specifically. So some people would only do that and, you know, adapt for plays and so on. But, and it's easier for those who are engaged in literature, either in school or in college or through work. But plays make it completely a different experience because let's be very honest, it's very difficult to just jump into Shakespeare to read it. I follow what's going on in schools. My kids are in British schools. So, and I would say it's given to a student, really, if the student is interested and if the student can. So I think as parents, we have to do a lot with taking them, you know, when we can. There are, it's adapted locally. I've seen staged in Kuwait. I mean, I can only follow English.
Sleiman Bassam, right?
So I think that's a very important part of it, but never really gets dull or old, which is great, as any great literature is. May I just go back to that set of skills and tools that you obtain when you're, because a lot of people who sat in your chair shared that even though they don't practice what they originally studied, for instance, that it has taught them something because it's such a specific setting. It is a system. There are rules. And for someone who has enjoyed studying as you have and continued working in the field, what are some of the best skills and tools you've taken out of that specific setting where you don't make the rules?
Yeah. I think for me, the first one would be the ability to focus.
Mm.
The ability to isolate yourself and focus. I think especially, you know, with the advent of social media around 2012, 2013, mm. that began to be challenged a lot. I could see creatives in my own cohort struggling with this. But for me, because I had already cultivated like a love of solitude that is dedication based.
Oh, I like that, love of solitude.
Yeah. Yeah, just, you know, going to the library and mm. then just shutting out the world for a few hours because you're reading and taking notes. I think that is a skill that will come in handy whatever you want to do in life.
Mm.
I think another one is the ability to hold complex ideas together. Right? When you study literature, you're not just talking about what's happening in a book, you're linking it to history, to politics, to theories, to what happened today and what might happen tomorrow. Mm. So that just ability to be able to hold complex ideas together, some of those ideas might even be paradoxical. In this world, a world where people are not encouraged to think or even punished for thinking outside of the box, I think this is also an incredibly important skill to have. And I think if I were to just mention at least a third one, it's the ability to connect through empathy rather than through judgment.
Mm.
Because when you're reading books by people who don't look like you, who don't sound like you, who've lived in different lifetimes, like, why am I reading a book about Russia, like Anna Karenina? Why am I crying over this book? I think that ability to be able to empathize with those who are different from you is also a skill that can transcend in all walks of life.
How about people who have influenced you during studies? Was there like one person or more people? How important is this role of a teacher?
I think it's incredibly important. Mm. And for me, a lot of people helped me. One of the first names that come to mind, and my God, I love him so much, and I'm going to get emotional because he recently left Kuwait, but he's been one of the most important, like almost parental figures in my life, and it's Dr. Pierce Smith. I met him at Kuwait University in a pivotal moment in my life, and in fact, he was the reason I decided, you know what, I'm no longer going to continue suffering in the College of Engineering. I'm going to transfer to the College of Arts and just live my life the way I want to live. So, yeah, major shout out to Dr. Pierce. But also, like, in the College of Arts itself, there's a roster of professors who were really, and you're, without them, I wouldn't be who I am today. Another name that comes to mind is Dr. Jamal Borisli. And he was, you know, on the conservative side teaching English literature. But my God, I have never loved a conservative man as much as I love this man, because he was genuine and he was kind and he was supportive. And he always had time for me. I'd always see him in office hours and I'd tell him, hey, I wrote a play. And he'd say, show it to me. Let me read it. So, yeah, there's so many. And Anthony Johe, Steele, Kenneth Payne, Dr. Abtihal Al-Khatib. Like, there are so many. I won't be able to.
I'm so glad there are so many.
So many.
This is not a case for everyone. We mentioned you are a writer and a translator, a literary translator. I am interested in these, how much they compete within yourself.
So up until very recently, there was no competition. I only saw myself as a writer, as I just mentioned, from the age of 17. Yeah. And in fact, I was walking around the hallways of Kuwait University saying very brazenly, I'm a writer, getting everybody mad at me because they're like, how dare you call yourself a writer when you haven't been published? And I'm like, I write, therefore I'm a writer. but nowadays, like, I've already been published, I've been, you know, nominated for awards, and those people who are mad at me are still unpublished.
Yeah.
Right? So forget about the publishing.
Mm.
Care more about, like, your relationship to your craft. But now we move on to translation. I was never somebody who thought...
How did you end up there in translation?
I I went to Colombia to study writing because I felt like at that time I had exhausted all of my knowledge and reached the highest level that I could reach of my own. And then I thought, I want to get better at poetry, but I was looking around me and I didn't see anything that was going to teach me advanced levels. Mm. So that's where I thought, okay, I'm going to go where the best of the best are gathered and I'm going to learn their own techniques. And when I went to Colombia, in that first week, the head of the literary translation program, Susan Bernofsky, she invited all of the students who had multiple languages to like a translation orientation. And then for the first time in my life, I heard someone talk about translation as anything other than politics.
Okay.
And she described it as the best tool that will enhance your creative writing. I was sold.
Booked. You
were. Yeah, sold. I was like, you're telling me that by learning translation, I can become a better writer? Okay, let me check it out and see. So I took a workshop. My first workshop with Katrina Dodson, who's amazing. She translated the award-winning collection of short stories by Clarice Lispector. And she was amazing. Like, I've never had so much fun in a workshop before. I decided to translate, just for fun, Buthayna Al-Isa's book, Khara'at al-Teh, which ended up becoming my translation thesis because I ended up majoring also in translation. And then I reached out to Buthayna and I sent her my sample and I said, hey, I just translated the first chapter of your book. If the copyright is available for purchase, let me know. I'm interested. And then that became my first debut translation.
Amazing. So this is also how you and Buthayna started the future creative collaboration for Lost in Mecca. Let's go back to writing, which is the first like big part of what you do. Is what do you write about? What are your topics?
Oh, good question.
How do you choose them? Yeah. Or do they choose you?
Honestly, I think for anybody, it should come naturally to them. Like, just keep a journal, see the things that you're interested in, and write the things that you're interested in. I think for me, because I cultivated my literary taste within the university campus, I always thought of life in more academic terms, right? So I'm not an academic, but I'm an artist who cares about how the book is read, not just how it is experienced. So, for example, while I was in university, I was always thinking, okay, why do people study English literature in Kuwait? English is not even our first language, technically, right? And we're reading literature by other people, by, British writers, American writers, French writers, Russian writers. But we're not being encouraged to write our own stories. And then what would that do if suddenly we have an opportunity to teach those young students in schools to not just write their own stories and their own voices, but to share it within with one another, what might change? So for me, the topics of identity, belonging, authenticity, empowerment, those became the subjects I was really interested in, and to explore them specifically through the lens of language and the way in which it allows us to reshape a sense of self within community.
Now that you have mentioned writing your own stories, I mean, in the language, in the local language, I just realized I want to ask you about how you feel about the local scene and writers. How much is that supported? Because you have to have a favorable environment to write and sustain your life through writing. And just generally, how you feel about the writer's scene in Kuwait?
Well, I have to say that I love them, absolutely love them, because some of them I've met 15 years ago. I've met them when they were young kids in school. And nowadays, there are colossal figures in the creative and artistic scene. So I'm touched, of course. I feel so proud of them. I want to support them in any way I can. And I think what they are doing is paving the path for even younger generations to get more support. So you're right in the sense that 15 years ago, the support that was needed was barely available. But when you get together, when you pool your resources, when you support one another instead of tear each other down, suddenly resources become more available for others to use.
How much is it of it is written in Arabic and a local dialect?
I don't know, because I focus primarily on the English language.
I understand, and sorry for not clarifying my question, but I am interested generally in... since you're a translator, and we were just prior to taping discussing, I was telling you how I spoke to translators and how much you need to have an immensely great understanding and knowledge of both languages you're using in translation. How much do we need to do, whether we're writing in English or in Arabic, to make sure that the language stays relevant and alive? In your own line of work, what do you do?
I'm going to be controversial, and I'm going to say that for like 15 years, I have been talking about the importance of the English language in Kuwait as a local language, right? So for me, it's not an either or, it's a both and situation. And I used to receive a lot of pushback for this idea that the English language is actually a local language in Kuwait. Maybe it's not something that is historical in the sense that it was there thousands of years ago, but in Kuwait specifically, it's a national language.
It potentially maybe even has more speakers. Maybe not more speakers, but... you know, very close
even
to the number of expats speaking, using the language actually as a common language.
Exactly. Yeah. And I feel like it's wrong to dismiss those people's experiences as lesser than or westernized. So I'm a big proponent of looking at the English language in Kuwait as a local language. And then let's talk about Arabic, right? Because now I feel like things might be moving in a better direction than they were, like with the abrogation of the censorship department in the Ministry of Culture. I feel like we're heading in a better direction, but Arabic for a very long time in Kuwait was extremely censored, and you know, it comes charged. There are things that you cannot say in Arabic in Kuwait that you could say in English, right? So I feel like if we want to nurture a love of the Arabic language in Kuwait, we must also free it, right? We must ground it in real, lived, physical experiences. We must even allow people to make mistakes in it and to write work that isn't the best, right? We have to allow the freedom of expression in order for us to also then generate a passion for the language. And for me, like I said, for a very long time, I avoided anything to do with translation in Kuwait because it always came packaged. Like it always came in with this like propaganda tool about identity and politics. And I'm a poet, right? I'm a creative. If I wanted to enter the world of politics, I would have entered the world of politics. But in Colombia, when I heard translation being talked about creatively, I thought, well, maybe I can even enter the realm of Arabic and its relation to identity and art. And who better to link all of those things together than Buthayna al-Isa, right? So I literally fell in love with the Arabic language through the translation of her book. And nowadays, I'm you know, Arabic is a beautiful language, but not if you censor it, only if you let it breathe.
The richness of it is so immense. I want to ask something more about the actual translation and writing. I keep asking you to decide.
Oh.
But it's so interesting. Not to decide between as much as to say what is harder or what is more rewarding. But you, this is just like an umbrella question. What I'm really interested in is how you somehow balance and harmonize these two different things, which are rooted in the same thing. But is there a thing that is harder for you Or it's more responsible, or it's even more rewarding when you write and when you translate.
I'll complicate this question and I'll add the third okay. skill, which is the coaching.
Go ahead. Yes.
Right.
Oh yes, we will come to yeah.
So I write. When I write, I'm writing original works. I'm trying to come up with fresh ways to express them. And for me, I always say, like, I like to either educate or entertain or empower in my writing. So at least that's what I want to do, write original works that do one of those three things. But then when I translate, the material is already there. I have no real input in whether this is original, or the content itself already exists. Yeah. So my job when I translate is to use the same set of tools that I have, the same building blocks, and to create an edifice that is authentic to the author, but might not necessarily be authentic to me, right? Mm. And now I'm going to complicate it with adding the coaching, because I am a certified coach for creatives. And among those three, it's actually the thing I love most. Like, among all of my children, my coaching is the one I love the most, because it allows me to do what I do with the writing and the translation, but to do it on an immediate level with somebody that I'm having like an intimate conversation with. And then I get to see that beautiful soul transform week in and week out. So which one do I love the most? I love coaching. And how do they differ? They all require a sensitive ear. The first one to the whispers of my soul, the second one to the whispers of the text, and then to the third one to the whispers of my client, like the whispers of my client's soul. What is my client not telling me that I think they need to hear? Because if they hear their own soul, they unleash wonderful creative talents in the world.
Since you've started this, I'd like us to move then to a little bit of more about the coaching, because that's such an interesting part of what you're doing and very unique. Could you first define it for us? You've said a bit of it about it, but what is creative coaching?
Yes.
And how, I know you actually have, you are a certified coach and this is a creative business you have created out of it, in a way, if I may use the word.
Actually,
it's official. It's licensed.
I was just going to say, like, we just got it licensed.
Yeah.
I mean, it was always professional, because I was always certified and I was able to take on clients. But now it's officially licensed by the government. And I'm really...
Amazing.
I'm happy.
Please tell us what it is. And if a person... Because you work with people from all Alice.
Yes.
And all fields of work and life, and I guess you'll tell us about the age as well. But what can one expect from these sessions with you?
Right. So I work primarily with creatives. Mm. And if you remember earlier, for me, creativity is an outcome, but also it's what happens within. Mm. So, for example, one of my clients, she wanted to start a business, but really where she was in her life at the time was as a mother who was struggling. Mm. And we didn't even get to the business, because first we needed to talk about, well, how can you show up creatively as a mother? Mm. How do you transform your relationship to your husband and to your child and to your responsibilities and to your sense of motherhood, right? So I work with people who want to increase their just genuine human creative skills. But then I also, the thing I love most is working with professional creatives, like people who are working on a book, who want to complete that book, people who, you know, want to launch businesses centered in their creative hobbies, like, you know, an editor, a YouTuber. So,
And these take time. Are they predefined, like, sessions, or you just go the way it takes you with the client?
No, I prefer to have packages because this way I hold my client accountable and we are very clear about the outcome. These aren't just like therapy sessions. We're not here just to talk. We're really here to transform our relationship to creativity in general, but also to complete something or produce something by the end of the package. So for example, one of the questions I will ask is, what are you working on and what's the deadline for this thing, right? So if you're writing a book and you want to complete your first draft in 6 weeks or in 12 weeks, then we're very clear about where we're heading. And it gives me an opportunity as a coach to genuinely hold you accountable. And if at some point along the way we're struggling, it really allows me to speak to you about, okay, what is the limiting belief that's operating right now? Is it perfectionism? Is it imposter syndrome, right? Or is it just distractions? Are you not prioritizing the novel because life is getting in the way? So what are some of the things we need to shift around in your schedule so that we can make that time available?
For you, both as a writer and a coach, is it transformational?
Yeah, it's not informational, it's transformational. Because, I mean, information exists everywhere. There's yani, not a dearth of it. There's so much information. You can download PDFs for free about how to write, how to, you know, create your first film, how to make your first music album. The question isn't that. The question is, can you do it once you know what to do? Like, you have the steps, but can you do it? And so coaching allows you to do a number of things. Number one, to be accountable, because you have an accountability partner, somebody who's like, hey, what did you do this week, right? But also, it is my job to be very attuned, not just to creativity in general, but specifically to my client. What is my client not telling me in this moment that needs to be addressed? Because a client doesn't know their own blind spots. Most of us, we believe the excuses we give ourselves. Yeah. If I'm procrastinating, I might tell myself, well, I need to clean my living room. Right, it's important. I need to vacuum. I need to mop the floors. But really, at the end of the day, what I'm not able to face maybe is the fear that if I write, it's not good enough. Right? Or maybe it's good enough, but somebody is jealous of me and they start to attack me. So I'm afraid of the response of somebody who might dislike me. Or maybe it is good enough and nobody's going to hurt me, but maybe I write something that makes my mom or dad disappointed in me, right? So it is those really hidden fears that a coach will be able to make visible for a client, and then not just make it visible, but give them the kind of tools that would allow them to work through the fears and then onto the page or onto the album or onto the film.
Tremendous work. I was wondering, as a writer, do you need a reader? Does you said the work doesn't need to be published for you to feel as a writer, as long as you're doing and working, or at least this is how you felt when you were studying in college. How is it now as a published writer?
I wanted to make those distinctions. Like, I always knew that I was going to be a writer before I got published, right? But if you remember, I'm not a humble writer. And I am somebody who is driven by getting better. And sometimes the best way for me to ascertain where I am in conversation with other writers is by entering competitions. I mean, even with poetry, I used to do spoken word poetry, so slam poetry competitions. And I'm not afraid of the competitive aspect of sports or of culture in general. So for me, it is important for me to be read. It's not just important for me to be read. It's important for me to be read at high levels. And I know that you don't start at that level. Like 15 years ago, I knew that where I was is not where I wanted to be. But that is a drive that allows me to challenge myself and take big risks and be responsible even for failure. Like, if I take a risk and I fail, I'm okay. Why? Because I want to get higher. Right.
And this answers a bit a question I had on awards and the importance of awards, because you have been nominated for numerous awards, I believe, for both writing and translation. Some of them are reputable awards, you might know some of the people who are, you know, delivering these awards and so on. So they play a role, I guess,
Yes. I'm not obsessed with awards. Like, I don't care about the award itself. I care about the symbol that I have been put next to other people and they've seen merit in my work, right? Which is why technically, like, I don't feel so bad if I don't win. As long as I'm, like, shortlisted or nominated, I know at least I'm in the conversation. So for me, it just shows me that whatever I'm doing is on the right track and I just need to push myself harder.
I would like us to mention your books because for someone who might not know, we keep mentioning that, but Fountain of Youth, Mischief Diary, Women of Kuwait. You had different, some of these you wrote, some of these were, you wrote them, but they were collaborative efforts. May we know more?
Yeah. So as I said, like, I'm somebody who likes to challenge myself. Mm. So none of my books are alike. I know there are some people who are like novelists or not just novelists, but like fantasy novelists. And then they write 20 fantasy novels. I'm not that kind of person. I'm someone who's always challenging myself to get better at my craft, because at the end of the day, I feel just responsible to my own potential. And so my first book, Fountain of Youth, is a collection of poetic vignettes, poetry mostly, but then some vignettes. And I wrote that in an interesting period in my life. Mm. I had just had what is colloquially known as a nervous breakdown. You know, the sad reality of a lot of creatives. Mm. But yeah, my brain broke. And then when it broke, I could no longer do the spoken word poetry that I was doing before. Previous to that, I was known as Kuwait's finest slam poet. Mm. I was just entering competitions and either winning first or second place. And then almost like overnight, I could no longer breathe. And when you can't breathe, you can't memorize. And if you can't memorize, you can't perform. Mm. And if you can't perform, you're suddenly riddled with anxiety. If you're on stage and you forget the lines and everybody has their phones up recording you, you no longer want to be seen, right? Almost overnight, I experienced such a different reality. Like, I became a different person. Weeks before that, I would stand on stage and recite without even remembering what the lines were. I'm thinking, what am I going to have for lunch today? Like, this is how comfortable I was on stage. And then almost overnight, I couldn't do it. It became just a struggle to be on stage. And I did see a therapist in that period. And this is what made me become a coach for creatives, by the way. Because that therapist, what she said, I think is really damaging. She said, if you can't write poems anymore, maybe you shouldn't be a poet. And I got so mad at her because I'm like, what are you even talking about? And it clicked for me that she was looking at my relationship to my craft as a layman would look at his relationship to his work. You know, like, oh, this is a capitalist machine and you need some rest from the hamster wheel. It's not. Creatives do not relate to their craft as work. We relate to it as a necessity, right? I live, therefore I create. So then don't tell me you can't write poems, so don't be a poet. Like, that's wild for me. Instead, ask me, you can't write stage poetry, how else can you write? Mm. And like this for me, when I started asking myself this question, the Fountain of Youth came to mind because, okay, I could no longer write poems for the stage. I can no longer memorize. I can no longer write with the intention of winning competitive cultural events, right? But what can I do? I can write softly. Mm. I can write on a page and then not know who's watching me. I can write and have distance from the response of the reader, which you can't have on the stage, right? So yeah, my first book came from that experience. I literally had to ask myself, I cannot do anything I could do before. So what can I do differently?
We will read this in a specific light you've just given us. And thank you for sharing that. The Mischief Diary I've read, very quickly. It's very easy to read. And if I may say, at first it seems, okay, this is easy book, you know. What did the... I'm not a big fan of Elizabeth Gilbert, but occasionally she says something funny like... you can gulp it down or something like that for some of her books. It is read very easily, but once you read it, something keeps coming back. And for me, that was a most beautiful part of it, which I've tried over the years, over the last years, since I've entered this mature period of my life, to take things with humor and to involve humor in everything, of course, the good kind. And humor comes out of this book, no matter the situations, and some of them are really hard or, you know, deep and layered and so on. I think this was purposeful, the humor and the laughter, but I would also like to hear from you, what was the purpose?
Right. So I actually wrote Mischief Diary around the same time I wrote Fountain of Youth. And again, it came out of this question, since you can't write the way you used to write, how can you write now? The first one was Fountain of Youth, which is how can I write about the trauma in a way that is soft but also distant?
And poetry.
Yeah, and poetry. And in Fountain of Youth, in Mischief Diary, then the question became, how can I write about the trauma as something other than trauma?
Mm.
How can I write about it in such a way that isn't about me expressing, but rather me connecting?
Mm.
And I thought, therefore, humor was the best transformative vehicle for a project like this. And by the way, my dad passed away in March 2024, and he's in the book, right?
Yeah.
So one of the decisions I had made at the time was I was going to write about the trauma in a positive light because I know maybe in the moment I'm in my feelings, I'm feeling angry or sad about certain situations, but I know from a humanity standpoint that what happens in chapter one is not what happens in chapter 30. Like, so the humanities gives you longer vision.
Mm.
And I knew that a book like this can immortalize the people in it. And I was writing about my family, and I wanted to write them in such a way that at the end of the day, they will remain endearing forever.
I believe now that I hear that you've succeeded.
Oh, thank you.
There is nothing hidden. We get everything that has happened. But at the same time, we see how you see it now and the work you've done in between. I think that was something that came out for it for me. But what a great thread, really. And also you write, so from your socials, from interacting with you, we see, and you've mentioned how much you've been invested in local community, how you are happy to share what others are doing, to support them, to show up at their readings, book signings, to talk about other people, to recommend them, and so on. What a wonderful thing to do. And what a rare thing to do, even though this is what we all talk about, that the community ties are based on. So one of the books you've also written is Women of Kuwait.
Yes.
And I think this is when I first heard of you.
Really?
I was trying to remember because I remember it was around the time that you either held or participated in a workshop in Sadu House where I was involved professionally at the time. And I believe this is, was it at that time the book that the book came out, 2019. But yeah. Was it written around that time?
So I actually wrote it in like 10 days.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. I connected with Mehel Asakir. So first, let me talk about my creative partner.
Yeah.
Mehel Asakir is a Kuwaiti visual artist. She is one of the best. She's one of the sweetest souls also.
Mm.
And I connected with her right before moving to New York to study in the MFA, creative writing MFA. She reached out to me and she said, Neda, I already showcased a gallery called Women of Kuwait.
Mm.
I already have photos of 27 amazing women that showcase like the modern or urban woman in Kuwait. She said, I'm working on a book and you came to mind. Would you be willing to write like the accompanying pieces for these women? So I was just moving to New York. My second book had just come out, Mischief Diary. It came out in 2018. And I thought, well, now I'm on the lookout for a new challenge, right? Because I don't write the same book all the time. I do different things with language. And I thought, I've never been in a position where I write about other people. My two books have been about my experience, right? The first one, talking about my sadness and then how to transform sadness into happiness. So now I was like, let's do it. How much do I have? And she's like, you have 10 days. So I'm like, wait, you're trying to tell me I have 10 days to interview 27 women and write an entire book about them? Like, this is crazy. But she's like, okay, I'll give you 2 weeks. It's like 14
very,
days.
Very, very gracious.
Yeah. But it was amazing. Like, Xenia, I can't even explain to you meeting those women. Mm. I would schedule them one after the other because I had to squeeze them in before I traveled, right? But then I realized we were having so deep conversations. Like there weren't even therapy. Like there were 10 therapy sessions in the space of 1 hour. So I was falling in love with all of these women one after the other because they were so amazing. And then I realized like I can't schedule them because they're crying and then the new interviewee would come in and they're waiting on the sidelines and they're thinking, what am I doing? What did I get myself into?
Yeah.
But then with some of them, I had to schedule them in New York. So I'm waking up at 3 a.m. in the morning to connect. Yeah.
I read how you decided, I will paraphrase, but please correct me, how you decided that it will not be just what kind of impacted them given the background, the social background, families, traumas, anything, but really what comes out of them as their unique light.
Yeah. So for me, my biggest challenge was I wanted to do a collaboration with a visual artist, right? What was Meha doing with the camera? Number one, she's going into their intimate spaces, their bedrooms.
Their bedrooms, yeah.
Number two, she's seeing all of them, but she's choosing snapshots.
One detail, yeah.
Like one or two shots that in her mind would capture a fleeting essence of that individual. Yeah. So then I asked myself, how can I reproduce that visual dynamic in a textual form?
Yeah.
So I would have sometimes from 1 to 4 hours conversations with them and they tell me about their lives and I'm asking them like probing questions. And then I will choose like one snapshot I would write about and I wrote it in the second pronoun. So these vignettes begin with you. You are standing. So I'm complicating the observer and who's watching and who's being watched, the subject and the observer. And then I'm also writing them in the present tense because like a photo, you're preserving the moment. So for me, it was an interesting challenge in a linguistic form.
I want to ask you to jump a little bit on the role of a writer and a translator and a creative coach, why not, in a deeply polarized world we have ended up in.
Yeah.
Do we have a role? Usually, writers have one of the grandest roles, historically.
Mm.
Social change, programmatic writing.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
So yeah, this is another one of those propaganda that whenever I talk to people who aren't creative, they will say something like, why are people writing poems or short stories in this like dark world? And again, for those people, like for my therapist, I will tell them, creatives do not create because it is something we do. We create because it is something we are. This is who we are. This is how we experience life through our creative drive.
Yeah.
And one of the best resources I would recommend any creative has, like to go out and actually buy, is a poetry anthology. Even if you're not a poet, please, I still recommend you buy it. It's called Against Forgetting, the 20th Century Poetry of Witness. The editor is Carolyn Forché, and she gathers in the 20th century only, not even in previous centuries, but just in the 20th century only, poems by individuals who were facing severe circumstances. So people who were writing poetry in concentration camps, Armenian poets who were writing in the midst of the genocide. Right? Mm-hmm. And if you read their poems, you will understand poets do not write because we are lofty and elitist and we want... We write because it is how we survive. It is how we make connections with the past. It is how we speak to the dead and keep them alive, right? So why do people write in polarizing times? Because we can't do anything else. It's the way that we survive.
And I feel it's the voice of normalcy and wisdom and on many occasions even of which to follow and where to go. I felt a couple of years ago when in Kuwait we started stopping the events and cultural events because we felt we cannot organize them due to happenings in Palestine. We should have done more of them.
Yeah. In fact, in 2021, when the Gaza genocide was taking place, I reached out to Palestinian poets and non-Palestinian poets. And myself, I funded an online...
I remember, I want us to mention that. Okay. I actually listened to that one. And you have sent me some very interesting material from that, which I cherish a lot.
Really?
Thank you. Just to add to how much Nada is sharing with the community. Yeah.
Because I really do believe it. Mm. Like, these were some of the best, in my opinion, Palestinian poets who were writing at the time.
They were from all sides of the world, if I remember.
Yeah.
I mean, from different countries.
Yeah. And now they're all acclaimed. Mm. George Ibrahim, Lina Khalaf Tifaha, Ruwa Zinati, like they're people to admire because they do the work that shows you the importance of culture and creativity in a politically polarized world, right? But honestly, I didn't just invite them. Like, I funded this whole thing myself. Mm. I invited them, and then I also invited members of my own community. Mm. Like, I invited Reed Saleh, who's now the creative director of Art Scene. I invited her sister, Rawa, who was the co-founder of Kuwait Poet Society. I invited Farah Lugayan. I invited Muna Karim, Karina. Like, I invited people that were part of my community that I thought deserved a platform with Palestinian poets who were writing in the midst of genocide. And then after asking them to share their poems, I asked them, why do poets still need to write poetry in this climate, right? So this is all available on YouTube if you're interested. I highly recommend the work. I think for me, this was one of the most meaningful labors of love in my life.
I remember the enthusiasm you had on that night or day. I think it was an evening.
Yeah.
The joy of sharing. So about something very difficult but at the same time shared with joy, which was really impactful for me.
Can I actually say, this is a really good point. Back to the anthology, and this would be the surprising part, because a lot of people can talk at creatives and they may judge creatives and they will tell creatives, how can you write about love in this climate? How can you make funny music or funny whatever in this climate? And yet I encourage you to buy that anthology, particularly because you can see, yes, there were poets who were writing about the reality of their experience. So in the middle of the Holocaust or in the middle of the genocide, talking about the Holocaust and the genocide. And yet what will surprise you is all of the other content that they write, the funny stuff, the light stuff, the love. Mm. Why is love important in a genocide, right? Mm. Because creatives are interested in all of the human condition. We're not interested in policing it, in tying it with a pretty bow for society to accept. Creativity is about complexity and depth and richness. And I give my creatives permission, write what you want when you want.
Yeah.
Let people shout if they want to. Let them moan if they want to. Do not internalize their emotional reactions because their emotional reactions are extremely limited in comparison to yours. And it is your job. God gave you the ability to be sensitive, the ability to be disruptive, the ability to be informative, use it. Because as a creative, what else can you do?
And in poetry, with poets, something is profoundly always oriented to future,
yeah,
to survival.
Yeah.
So many things to talk about, and we're nearing the end of our conversation, unfortunately, but good Schlagwort, as a German would say, for a future conversation. What do you read nowadays? What are you reading nowadays, and what can you suggest us to maybe not miss?
So listen, I usually read nonfiction and poetry, generally speaking. These are like most of the books that I read. But this year, I made a decision that I wanted to read more fiction. And I discovered two of the most amazing book clubs in Kuwait. So I'm going to use this opportunity to give them a shout out.
Please do.
Samira Jaffer is a Kuwaiti writer, and she hosts a women's only book club called The Shelf. Amazing.
I'm going to write it down.
Yes, please. You should join us, Ksenia.
I should.
Ksenia, it's amazing. The people there are amazing. The way that Samira like facilitates, and just the way that it's democratically organized, people get to choose the book. It's just so amazing. And they're reading Atessa Mushfig's A Year of Rest and Relaxation.
Okay, I've read
Perfect.
It.
Perfect. But I also shout out to another also women's only book club, Dana's Kuwait Literary Lounge. Also, some of my favorite people. I can't even, I swear.
So good to have your people.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The sweetest. They're both very different. Samira's book club is bigger. Dana's book club is smaller. And Samira's book club usually focuses more on contemporary women's fiction. Dana's book club focuses more on classic works. So I think we're reading now Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. So if ever, anybody's interested. But my God, the highlight of my 2025 is joining those two book clubs, because not only am I reading new works that I wouldn't have myself picked off the shelf, but I'm doing it in community with some of the most like amazing people.
So how do you rest with all that you do? Do you need rest? How do you rest? How are you ready to create from scratch again?
Honestly, my answer to that before my dad's passing would have been, I'm a rising in Capricorn, so I don't rest. I'm a workaholic. And honestly, I would have told you, do you blame me? I'm doing the things I love. Like, why would I want to rest from reading or writing or going to cultural events or spending time with cultural enthusiasts? But honestly, when my dad passed in 2024, I was forced to figure out what rest would look like, because, you know, I didn't want to reach a level of burnout and then not be able to show up for my community. So I'm happy to say I discovered what rest means for Neda Faris. I joined
We're
the
glad.
Gym. Yeah, I do kickboxing now.
We saw that on social media.
Really?
You seem really good at it.
Thank you. Well, I mean, it's just me learning on my own, but I really do like it. And I think this is one of the very few things that I do that isn't in service of anyone else but me.
But just yourself. Yeah.
And then just a shout out also to Pokemon, because I play Pokemon online and I think I love it. People think it's a phase, but I'm almost 40 now and I can't get over how much I love Pokemon.
No, actually, Pokemon is very much a member of our family.
Really?
So, yeah, different things related to Pokemon.
Yeah.
We still go around and search for, you know, for Pokemon Go. And in COVID, we realized that one of the neighborhood mosques has the most rewards, you know, and then we'd be just circling around. Yeah. No, I get that. This is this is the playfulness that we must keep. Any plans you would like to share?
Yes.
Or where people can find you, what they can join. We didn't have today enough time to mention, but Nada does creative writing workshops. You do different lectures.
Yeah.
People can engage with you in all of the fields you're active in for different kind of activations and so on.
I think,
what is something in the plans for you?
The best way to stay in touch with me is through Instagram, at the Nada Faris. And you're right, I just licensed the company, so I'm hoping over the summer to prepare a set of workshops. And I do two types of workshops, technical workshops for creative writing, but also reflective workshops as a certified coach for creatives. I'm always interested in giving people practical tools to help them overcome, for example, their negative voice, connect to their higher purpose, or just to, you know, get down and dirty working on their craft, figuring out what does creativity mean to me, right? How do I want to present myself as a creative? What is my relationship to confidence or humility? Do I have to adopt what is trending, or can I come up with my own definitions?
Thank you so much for sharing all of this and for today's conversation, which has been very rewarding for me and enjoyable tremendously. We hope to see you soon, Nada. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Thanks.